compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, man, I can't believe how fast the time goes by. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go. I'm going to get back to your phone calls in a second, though. First, I want to catch you up on some inclusive language updates. This, by the way, is courtesy of the Office of Information Technology at the University of California, Irvine, UCI. Remember when I was in high school in Southern California and all the smart kids would go off to UCI to study math or architecture or something like that? But great school, Southern California, but the Department of Information Technology has got some inclusive language pointers that they want you to know. So, Cyrus, I don't know if you're planning to get your PhD anytime soon at the University of California.
If you do,
please be forewarned. These are some of the things. Now, this does not extend, as far as I'm aware anyway, to the entire school. I believe that this is simply this particular department. But the disclaimer at the top of this four-page PDF says, UCI is committed to equity, diversity, and inclusion. Language used by the Office of Information Technology must reflect these values. So it is from this particular department, but I believe it's reflective of the school as a whole. So they give some tables. They want you to favor gender-neutral terms whenever possible. Avoid constructions like he or she or he, she. So, for example, don't say he or she, say they or them. Don't say his or her, say their.
Patrick.
Don't say guys and
gals.
Okay,
I'm confused. Yes, so if you're talking about a singular person, how can you call
them?
You
must use the plural.
How they're not a they. You want to call them the?
Well, they is what they say you should say.
They means so, like a bunch of people are saying that. But we're talking about one.
So
where's this? Where's the tape?
Okay, so, hey, Cyrus is going out to lunch. I wonder what they are going to get for lunch. Hey, Cyrus is in the studio. I wonder what they are doing in the studio. That's, yes. It's the only real solution to things like this is to have duct tape on hand. Somebody came up to me the other night. I was speaking in, where was I? I was somewhere. I know I was somewhere. I was speaking at, oh golly, I don't remember now where I was. I was speaking, this just a week ago, I was speaking at a parish. Oh, I know where I was. I was in Noblesville, Indiana. That's where I was last week, just outside of Indianapolis. I kid you not. Somebody came up to me. She's a listener of the show, and she says, I'm sorry, I don't have any duct tape for Cyrus. So people are now apologizing for not bringing duct tape to these speaking events. Three or four people over the last 6 or 8 months have brought duct tape, and we use it regularly on the program. Okay, so get the duct tape ready. So you can't say he or she, you got to say they or them. Can't say his or her, say their. Guys, gals must be folks or team or y'all. Boy, do I hate that. Oh, I hate this too. I really hate this. I see people using y'all on Twitter, and I don't know what they think that looks like, but I think it looks silly. Y'all this, y'all that, y'all this. Anyway, and I'm not talking about people from down south. If you're from down south, fine. That's just how people talk. But, you know, this affectation of y'all just seems silly to me. So anyway, so don't say guys or gals, say y'all or team or folks. Don't say chairman, say chair. So now you're reduced to a piece of furniture. Can't be a chairman or chairwoman. Oh, you could be a chairperson. But see, even that word is problematic because it's got the word son in it, which is not gender neutral. Man or mankind must be replaced by humanity, people or humankind. And of course, humanity and humankind are also verboten because they have the word man in it. So they don't want you to say mankind, they say humankind, but you still have the word mankind in humankind. Yeah, I don't know if we're going to have enough. So sister school or sister campus must be replaced by other UC campus. You can't have something grandfathered in. It must be legacy status or pre-existing. Cyrus, you're no longer my right-hand man, at least according to UCI. You're now indispensable.
Oh,
or counterpart.
I liked Indispensable.
You kind of like that.
Yeah,
huh?
That's all right. So this isn't all bad.
But it makes you like a dispenser, like a candy dispenser or a soap dispenser. So you've been reduced now to an inanimate object.
Pez.
That's how I, yeah, Pez, there you go. Man hours, manpower, can't say that. Person hours or engineer hours or level of effort. Can't say man in the middle. attacker in the middle.
Man in the middle.
Yeah, cut out the middleman, I guess. You can't say that anymore. So be mindful of layers of meaning, they say, behind your word choices. The history of a term matters, but connotations gained since the coining of a term matter too. So words to be avoided, whitelist, blacklist, white box, black box, native feature, first class citizen, or housekeeping tasks should be replaced respectively by allowist instead of whitelist, allow list.
Yeah, that's easy.
Hey, am I on your allow list?
It rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah. Instead of blacklist, it's deny list or block list. Instead of white box, it's glass box testing. Let's see. You can't say this is a native feature of the product. You say this is a built-in feature. So they just want you to avoid words that might have some connotation in some other context. You can't say the master branch. You can't say user with a visual impairment. You now must say screen reader magnifier user. You can't refer now to somebody who's hearing impaired. You must say deaf or hard of hearing. Now, I've got to pause here because I remember, and this seems to me it was long about the 1970s, when you were told you were not allowed to say deaf or hard of hearing because that was offensive. You had to say hearing impaired. Now, hearing impaired is offensive, and you have to say deaf or hard of hearing. Does that make any sense to you? Doesn't make any sense to me.
I guess I'm just too insensitive. Okay. And, you know, a racist sexist.
You can't say that you're going to cripple something. You're going to cripple the system or cripple the whatever. You now have to say hinder. You can't say you're blind to this or deaf to this. You have to say ignore. You can't say tone deaf. You have to say inconsiderate, thoughtless, or careless. You can't have a sanity check, but you can have a quick check or a confidence check or a coherence check. I think they need a coherence check, honestly. Avoid slang and idioms that can confuse or detract from your message. Do not rely on implicit contextual understandings that may not be shared by your audience, as they may be separated by time, distance, and culture. So you're not allowed to say anything ever, because something you might say could offend somebody somewhere at some time. So you can't say to kill, like to kill a process. Just kill that project. You have to say stop or halt. You can't say kill two birds with one stone. Yes. You can't say kill two birds with one stone. They want you to say feed two birds with one scone. All is going to become clear now. When I read that story about why it's bad to feed birds bread, it was from this.
It's all tied.
It was from this.
Full circle.
Yeah, it's all tied together. So UCI wants you to kill birds. They're bird haters. Because you can't kill two birds with one stone. You have to feed two birds with one scone, they say.
How dare they?
It's speciesist at its worst.
There's got to be people listening that are like, what are they talking about?
I know. This was the connection. So, you know, my bad. I got the two backward. But had I been thinking more clearly, I would have gone from this story about you can't say kill two birds with one stone. You have to say feed two birds with one scone. Then I would have pivoted effortlessly into the story from Lifehack about how if you feed birds scones, you're going to kill them. You'll cook their goose. I wonder if UCI would allow me to say that.
Yeah, I don't think you're supposed to say that. Pete is going to get on you.
Yeah. So there you have it. And we'll post this if you're interested. These are the gender inclusive language IT department language guide things. And I think it's nonsensical. But amazingly, people more and more are doing this. You know, more and more now also you see people who and there's some parodies of it, but some of it's actually not parody. It's actually just real world where you have business meetings on Zoom or something and people identify themselves with their pronouns. When I see somebody on social media who just routinely, without smirking without, you know, thinking that this is a joke, but they're just routinely giving me their pronouns, I realize that's not somebody I want to be connected to on social media. If they're that far gone into this craziness that they're going to just volunteer their so-called pronouns in their social media profile, it's just like, eh, no. Block sometimes. It just doesn't go for me.
It's really sad. There's so much. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's.
Let's get back to what you were talking about, Cyrus.
There's a mental health issue here that no one's talked. It's totally not talked about at all.
Two birds with one scone now?
Well, all right. Let's move on.
Okay, go ahead and tell me. What is the mental health issue?
No.
Is this.
You know.
Are you sharing or what?
Let's go.
You want to move off of that?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go now to Victor in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Victor. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm responding to the woman who called about the draft and the language that's in the National Defense Authorization. And I know this has been coming for a while. I spent 30 years in the Navy. I went to the Naval Academy. I was the first class with women. My issue really with this is the fact that the country has so disenfranchised being a patriot. That's why we're seeing a reduction in young adults wanting to come into the military, which is why the Congress is even considering having to put this registration for the draft. So I really believe, you know, there's an issue in the country. You know, if you're a patriot, you get slammed by the media. You know, you get bad press.
Even the word patriot.
I think it's very difficult.
Even the word patriot has bad connotations in the minds of most on the left. Even just the American flag, if you display the American flag, that has negative connotations for many people in this country nowadays. It's very sad. So let me ask you, Victor, when you were in the Naval Academy, you said your class was the first one to have women admitted to the academy?
Yes. Yeah.
So
we had the first,
a natural question that comes up is 81 of them?
Yep. And then we graduated, about 36 of them, I think. So, and these women were patriots. They were patriots and they were, you know, awesome individuals. I can't fault that. I probably have a different view of you and your caller as to the fact that women can serve in the military. I mean, you have women who are Joint Strike Fighter pilots now. You have women SEALs. You have women on submarines.
I don't know how much of the show you listen to, but I said that I'm fine with all that. And I support women who want to be in the military. Do we differ? I mean, oppose that?
No, I think the best way to have a very successful military is to have a volunteer military, because those are people that want to serve your country. They want to be patriots. They want to do these things. But when you have a country that so disenfranchises young adults from wanting to be patriots, from, you know, talking so badly about it in the media, it becomes a very difficult situation. And it's just horrific. It really is horrific.
So then maybe you and I don't really disagree then, because what you just said is something that I personally agree with. Where I disagree, and I don't know what your stance is on this issue, but I would disagree with drafting women. That I disagree with.
Well, I think the draft as a whole is problematic, because surround your forces with people that don't want to be there. And so that becomes very difficult as a leader, you know, a person that's had to lead thousands of people, you know, people that are not in, who are there, who don't want to be there, they are many times, you know, more problematic. So
a volunteer force is the way to go. What do you do from a practical standpoint? What do you do where, and this is just a question because I've never been put into a situation where I've had to be responsible for anything like that, but what do you do in time of war where you need more bodies, you have to have more bodies to fight the war, and we have a long history of, you know, men being called up to serve in draft situations? What about that? I mean, when there's an absolute necessity, do you say, well, let's just grin and bear it, or are you still opposed to it?
Well, I think you have to look at the history of the last, you know, 40 years, we haven't had an issue with getting enough people to volunteer. I would say if something happened today, that might be an issue, because you have such a young generation that does not want to be in the military, that does not want to be a patriot. They don't want to serve their country. And it presents the Congress with this difficult situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So if, let's say that this all passes, and it looks to me like it's going to, and let's say that, I don't know, 5 years from now, we'll throw a dart. Let's say that the draft is reactivated 5 years from now. Do you think that it would be reactivated because not enough young people are voluntarily going into the military? Do you think that could be a trigger for something like that, where they just don't have the numbers?
Well, I think it is. That's the whole reason they came up with the plan. If the Army, the Marines, you know, the Navy, the Air Force, the Space Force, if they don't meet their quotas, and I believe I've read recently that the services are having trouble meeting their quotas, then they're going to have to do something different. I mean, as long as nothing happens globally and they don't have to worry about sending over forces, then we're okay. But I think, you know, I think I'm worried. I'm worried about the numbers. We all should be worried.
I share that concern. Yeah, I share that concern. So one last question I have is, what about automation? What about robots and things? I understand that you're retired now, but did you see the U.S. military moving in the direction of replacing human beings with robots and drones and things like that? Because from where I sit as a civilian, it seems like that's a good idea. If we can have fewer people in harm's way and have more robots out there getting shot at, that seems like a better thing to me.
Well, I agree. There's a lot of opportunity for drones, you know, airborne drones, underwater drones. I've seen some of these Army, you know, service dogs that are robots. But I still think, you know, the bottom line is, if you have to send in ground forces, you're going to need people on the ground. So, and even the Navy, you know, the Navy is buying drones for electronic, you know, surveillance and counterintelligence, and they're buying drones on the aircraft carriers now for fueling of the fighters, but they're not buying drones for the actual combat missions, because I believe that, you know, that's very technically involved, to be able to have a decision tree without a man. There I go. I'm violating your rules. Without a person.
they're not my rules. They're not my rules. I'm okay with manpower. Hey, I had before I have to go, I had a son who served 10 years in the nuclear Navy. He was a nuclear engineer and was on a fast attack sub. And man, did he tell me some amazing stories about life in the U.S. Yep. Navy. You probably could tell a few yourself.
Thanks for his service, by the way. And again,
thank you, Victor.
I think we need to address this patriotism issue, because I really see it as a cultural problem right now. The Democrats are really against the patriots, and it's going to hurt us.
Yeah. Well, let's pray it doesn't. What's the old saying, that pray as if everything depends upon God, and work as if everything depends upon us? I think that's a good way to go about it nowadays. Thank you for the call, Victor. I appreciate it very much. Very enlightening. I'm going to be back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show and your phone calls on the other side of this quick timeout. So please stay right there. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
It's that time. Christmas time is here. Everybody knows there's not a better time of year.
Welcome back. Thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ann now, listening in Utah. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
I was calling in response to the caller who was discussing the draft of females into the military. And
yes.
The reason I was calling was because I am actively engaged by DOD and I was previously a veteran for 10 years. And your caller made a comment specifically stating that women in the military were not allowed to have children. And the reason I called was I was compelled to just inform your listeners that that's an inaccurate statement. I had my son while I was active duty military. I was a Desert Storm, Desert Shield veteran. And I had my son and took him overseas with me up until the point I was deployed into the theater, in which case you have a designated individual that will take, you have a short-term and a long-term designated guardian that will come and take your child immediately. And it's someone you select to take your child for you in the case that you're deployed and you don't have immediate family away around. And then you have a long-term guardian who's designated, which is typically, you know, the other spouse, or a lot of times it's the grandparents or an aunt or uncle or something like that. So the military knows who your child's supposed to go with.
Okay.
And so just to say, you know, so there are female veterans that do have children, and there's a process and a procedure in place to ensure that our children are taken care of in the event that we're deployed to any type of environment. And even for military training for, you know, five or six weeks, like, you know, officer training school, something like that. So I just wanted listeners to know that. And then on top of that, I continue to work for DoD now, and I work with Air Force and Space Force very closely, and I work in their research, development, and training acquisition of future weapon systems and cyber systems. Yes, I just wanted to say that right now what's happening in the military, your previous caller that spoke and said we had a shortfall of active duty people, I so concur with that, but I want to also say that the individuals that we have are of the highest caliber. They're wonderful, and I'm extremely fond of many, many of them because they're very dedicated and highly intelligent individuals. But, you know, let's face it, in today's economy, people that are very good software writers for like CyberScript, et cetera, they don't want to work for the military. They want to go work for Google. You know, they want to make the big bucks. They don't want to be constrained to live the military lifestyle, the physical fitness, the sacrifice of oneself. But anyways, I want to walk that back just a minute. I know that your case in point was, should females be drafted? And I would not support that ever, for main two reasons. Is that one, there's an emotional, I would just call it predisposition, to someone to be able to serve in a hostile or stressful environment. And I think you have to be somewhat prepared for that. And not everyone can do it. It truly is a calling in a way. My whole family, brothers, sisters, fathers, my father was a nuclear engineer in the Navy, and he worked on the Trident nuclear subs. I mean, it's something that you are, if you will, groomed the strength of having longed absences away from, like, your parent. You know, my father, when they were doing the
I have a question, man,
with the nuclear
if
stuff.
I can jump in. If I can jump in. What about the women who are single and serving in the military who get pregnant while they're on duty? That's a whole separate category, different from the woman like yourself who's married and maybe has a child, or maybe is pregnant before she goes to a theater for whatever reason. But my understanding is that another big problem is, and of course it may not be anywhere near as big as it might be if it weren't for contraception, but for those women who are serving and they get pregnant while they're on duty, these things happen. What is the procedure for a woman in the military who turns up pregnant?
Right. So if that happens, so when they're put on a limited duty, so they can't go into a hostile environment because they are with child. Number two, they're given the option that if they want to separate, they can do so, you know, fairly quickly. They can put in the paperwork and say, I want to terminate my military. I mean, they're not held to their entire enlistment. If they want to stay and be like a career military person, like I did, and I did it not necessarily out of want, but more out of financial necessity, because we were military married to military, and we just couldn't afford for me to get out. So during that time, I had a maternity leave, and now they even have parental leave for the males that are become new fathers so that they can have time to bond with their children. So they have like a family leave, not just for the mom, but for the dad too.
Right. I'm talking here about the 22-year-old single female. She's in the military. She gets pregnant. So the military offers her the option to separate. They offer her, she can go take time off to have the baby and then come back. Is that right?
Yes, she can. She can. And then again, she'd have to fill out the paperwork about the guardianship for her child in the event that she was deployed, a short-term guardian and a long-term guardian. That would take that child, but that would be her choice. Like she can, and that's why ultimately I got out because I
see what my problem with this, and here's one of the big problems for me is that the military is all about being prepared to fight, if that's what it should come to. Now I realize that, you know, there's a humanitarian aspect to all of this where we're human beings and we have to take that into account. I don't argue with that at all, but it seems to me that this is ultimately a problem that taxes the military, it taxes readiness. If you've got a woman, let's say, who is all trained up, she's gone through all of her training, she's physically fit, she's in her, you know, in her duty doing whatever she does, and then she winds up getting pregnant, then all of that has to get put on hold. All of that investment, all of that preparation and training is now basically worthless for the time being. It may be worthless indefinitely if she decides to get out. So I don't know whether there's a ready solution to this, but to me that seems problematic that the military would be positioned in such a way that these highly trained, poorly paid, but highly trained, highly capable people suddenly now get taken out of the readiness force, especially now at a time when we really desperately need people to be ready to counter a threat from China or from Iran or from Russia. Or who knows who else? I don't have an answer, as I say, but it does strike me as these policies would seem to me to weaken the readiness of our armed forces. I don't know. Those are my thoughts as I think about this, Anne. Any final thought before we have to go?
Well, I would just sort of counter to that. I agree from that perspective, but also, if that individual, and there are very many highly competent female military officers that have served and enlisted, and I have one that I work very close with right now, and I think the world of her, and she has three children. I would just say that, you know, maybe this is something that they were called to do. They're highly, you know, administrative jobs. They're not necessarily out on the front lines where they're going to take a bayonet and stab somebody, but they are of an engineering mindset. They're highly organized.
Right.
They can grasp it. And so they are engaged.
I don't dispute those aspects of it. Mm-hmm. In other words, I don't quibble on those points, and I believe that what you're saying is absolutely true. I guess what I'm saying, though, is that in the bigger picture, especially since physiologically women can get pregnant, and if you have women and men close together, especially in stressful situations, nature naturally is going to take its course more often than not. So this is part of my overall hesitation, especially with the draft, drafting women. This is sort of part of that, is that whether we like it or not, these situations where women in the military turn up pregnant, it just serves to weaken the overall readiness of our forces for the reasons I mentioned. Anyway, I do appreciate you shedding some light on this, especially from your perspective as having been in the military, and thank you for that. I appreciate it. Let's go now to Joe in Mesa, Arizona. Good morning, Joe.
Morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You got it.
The reason I'm calling is me and my wife and I have recently been having some issues with bringing our two-year-old to Mass. And it's turning into an issue where she really doesn't want to go anymore. And we had a conversation the other night, and it turned into an argument, unfortunately, about her just basically saying what would happen if I don't go to Mass.
When you say her, are you talking about your wife or your daughter?
Oh, no, my wife. Sorry. We have a two-year-old son.
Okay. Oh, son. Okay.
And
got it.
Yeah, and so we got into a little bit of an argument, and basically she asked what would happen if I don't go anymore because it's so frustrating for me. And my short answer was, well, you would go to hell because it's a mortal sin to not go to Mass. And that didn't go over well. So kind of a two-part question. What would be a better way of responding to that or talking to her about that? And then I know you have 11 children. Any suggestions that you would have as far as bringing the little ones to Mass with us?
Okay, why don't we start there, and then I'll work on my way over to the question about your specific situation. So, yeah, Nancy and I, 11 kids, we, you know, no twins, no triplets, and the same wife. So we had them all one by one, and they all went to Mass always from the very beginning, from their youngest days. We would try to get the kids baptized at about 2 weeks after they were born, and they were going to Mass from that point forward. And when... if part of the issue is your ability to concentrate on what's going on at Mass, and I could understand if that is an issue, we had to deal with those things. And so because it was the two of us, Nancy and I, one could juggle the baby and maybe take the baby outside or the toddler outside to the vestibule or someplace where the child's noises would not bother the people in the congregation. I think that's a very... a kind and appropriate thing to do for parents to, when their kids are making a fuss, making a commotion, to just take them out quietly and stand maybe in the vestibule, or if there's a cry room, that's fine, or just someplace nearby until the child settles down, then bring the baby back in again. It's inconsiderate, if you ask me, of a parish to make parents and families feel unwelcome. Do we want to make them feel welcome? Because they are welcome. And those children are the future of the church. So we don't want to be inconsiderate from the standpoint of the parish or the ushers or the other parishioners. We want to welcome these families with their children and all the noises that the children make. But at the same time, I think that the parents themselves should be considerate and should step outside when the child is making a commotion. It's the charitable thing to do, because there are other people who are very distracted by that. So you try to do the best for your brother. And if that kind of a harmonious balance exists, I think things are great. So everybody feels welcomed. Everybody's looking out for everyone else. We always had our kids with us in Mass, and we never said, well, you can stay home because you're too young. We just always brought them to Mass from the very beginning. And they learned how to pay attention. They learned how to follow. Now, when they're very young, they can't obviously follow along. So we would bring, you know, like religious coloring books or religious books that they could look at. Now that I think about it, I don't remember that we brought coloring books, but we would bring the little kids' books about the Mass or about Jesus or about the saints. And they could look at that during the times of the Mass where they were just sort of detached from what was going on. But we made them pay attention, and they grew into that, and they paid attention. One other thing, and I don't know if this is part of your question, Joe, but as long as we're on the topic, you know, we didn't bring Cheerios, we didn't bring snacks, we didn't bring food for the kids, because we wanted them to understand that this is something different. This is not playtime. This is not, you know, food time. This is God time. And so everyone's different, but that's how we did it. We just never brought any snacks or food. Now, a bottle for the baby, sure. You know, that's necessary at times. So beyond that, the best thing I can say is that we helped each other. So sometimes Nancy would juggle the baby, and I would keep an eye on the kids who were there in the church. Sometimes it would be me. But between the two of us, we worked it out, and we were able to go to Mass. And by all means, if you're at Mass and you have a fussy or fidgety baby and you have to go out into the vestibule, it's not like you're missing Mass. You're still at Mass. You still receive the graces. You can go to communion. God understands that you have these parental duties. So I think maybe one good solution would be for you and your wife to approach this as a team and say, we've got a toddler who can be a bit noisy or fidgety, and we'll take turns taking care of the baby so that the other one can focus more on the Mass, and it will all work out in the end. I think if you can approach it from that teamwork standpoint, it could be very, you know, very good, and everybody's happy and nobody is missing Mass. Now, as to your point about missing Mass, you're right. If somebody doesn't have a serious reason for missing Mass, it could be illness, could be an occupation that requires you to be in the emergency room delivering a baby, or maybe not emergency room, in the delivery room delivering a baby on a Sunday morning because you're a physician or a nurse. There are certain extenuating circumstances where you're unable to get to Mass on Sunday, and you're not obliged to follow the Sunday obligation if it's beyond your control. And you just can't get to Mass. The church understands that. But if you can go to Mass and you don't, you're right, that is a serious sin. If somebody were to die in the state of serious sin, he would go to hell, sadly. But that's the long and the short of it. So perhaps the way you express that part of it to your wife might have been a little bit blunt. But the main thing I would try to do is concentrate on the positive and the fact that you're a team, husband and wife, raising a baby, and you want the child to grow up in the faith with all the signs and symbols of the faith from the time he's little. That's how I would try to approach it, Joe. What do you think?
Yeah, no, and that's, I think the a big one is me being a little bit more of a team player, like you had said. And I think the hardest thing for her, as far as besides just dealing with the stress of a screaming 2-year-old, her big thing is she feels like she can't pay attention, and so she's getting nothing out of it. And I've tried to kind of explain to her that even if you can't really hear what's going on, we're here and we're receiving the graces of being at Mass and being able to receive communion. So,
and that's all true.
Yeah, I think definitely.
How about this? Yeah. How about this? Why don't you say, all right, honey, fair enough. I'll be the one who takes care of the baby. So you can concentrate. You'll never have to lift a finger. So when we go to Mass and the baby fusses, I will take care of the baby. You can concentrate. Problem solved.
Definitely. I like it.
She may say, well, you know, she may sense that there's sort of an imbalance in the division of labor here, but that's okay. I mean, if that's her real reason, and let's assume it is, then make it as easy as possible for her to concentrate at Mass, and she'll see what a diligent and devoted husband and father you are. Points for you. You know, the baby is.
Yeah, I need all the points I can get too, Patrick.
Well, there's a few points for you at your fingertips.
Awesome. I really appreciate it. I love your show. I listen to you every day. Thank you again so much for taking my call.
Thank you, Joe. Good to talk to you. And you remind me of me when I was a young dad at your phase in the game. So God bless you and your wife and your children. Let's see. Yeah, we're overdue for a break. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back right after this. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Joyous, St. Nicholas, lean your ear this way. Don't you tell a single soul what I'm gonna say.
Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Real life solutions you can believe in.
The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Santa, bring my baby back to me. I don't need a lot of presents to make my Christmas bright.
We're still in Advent, but we're also gearing up for Christmas. Hence the Christmas music. Welcome back. Let's go now to Ann in Appleton, Wisconsin. Good morning, Ann. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you. I went to confession on Saturday, and at the time, you know, I got my absolution, et cetera, but my penance was to 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes at night do a centering prayer. Well, at first he said, will you do that? Because he wanted me to check back, like, at Christmas time to see if I've done it and how things went. Well, I thought, got thinking it sounded kind of hippy-dippy centering, so I looked it up, and it seems like the Catholic Church frowns upon that. So I didn't do it, and I'm wondering, I'm assuming my sins were still forgiven, but and I kind of made up my own penance, but what else should I do, or is it, am I correct assuming that my sins were forgiven? Okay.
Yes, they were forgiven. So the you were truly sorry for your sins, and you confessed all your sins without holding anything back, right?
Right.
Yeah. So you're in the clear.
Correct.
Now,
okay.
This would be an example of where perhaps the priest is an enthusiast of the centering prayer methodology, and if you wanted kind of a lengthy description of the problems with centering prayer, I would go to Catholic Answers website, Catholic.com, and just type in centering prayer, and it will pull up a number of articles that will give you, you know, some specifics about what the problems or incompatibilities are. So in this case, you simply substituted other prayers for that centering prayer. Is that right?
Well, I said I wasn't going to do that twice a day, and I took a penance that the previous time I went to confession, the priest had me do, so I did that. Yes.
Okay. So what I would say is
which is prayer. So. Okay.
Sure. Sure.
And he's not my regular parish priest either. It was in a different town, so. But I told him I would do that. So when I feel bad that I said yes, and I'm not going to, you know, follow up.
I understand. So a penance can be commuted, and in this case, you sort of commuted it yourself. And under the circumstances, I don't see anything problematic with that. But I was just going to say that the next time you go to confession, you might want to say, oh, mm-hmm. and by the way, Father, the last time I went, this is a different priest, last time I went, he gave me a penance that involved a questionable type of prayer activity. And I sensed that there was, you know, a problem with that. So I substituted my own prayers in lieu of that specific form of prayer that he asked me to do. And I just want to mention that in this confession. So everything's out in the open. And then I'm sure the priest will say that's fine. That would be my guess.
Okay. Oh, okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome, Ann. Thank you. Thank you. Go in peace, as Jesus said. Thank you. Let's go to Harry now in Fallbrook, California, a town I know very well. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the program.
Yes. My question is if you can explain what Gnosticism is.
Gnosticism is a, among other things, it was an early church heresy that was known by a few key characteristics. One is that even just the word Gnosticism itself, it's from the word in Greek gnosis, which means knowledge. And one of the hallmarks of Gnosticism as a sort of general movement, it wasn't all one thing. There were various versions of Gnosticism, Christian Gnosticism being one of them. But one of the hallmarks was the belief that there was certain arcane special knowledge that only the initiated few were permitted to know. And as you were initiated into, whether it's the pagan version of Gnosticism or the Christian version of Gnosticism, that this secret knowledge that you were admitted to would allow you to rise higher in terms of your own awareness of consciousness, ability to be spiritual. Now, this was also accompanied by a general view of the universe as both good and evil. So it was a dualistic view that especially physical things were evil and spiritual things were good. So the body was considered evil. There was this whole panoply of heavenly personages that the Gnostics tended to believe in that would include demiurges, a good god, a bad god. The bad god was responsible for the earth, in other words, for physical things. And they reasoned that because pain and misery and suffering resided in the physical realm, that physical things must be bad, and the spiritual realm was what you wanted to escape to. So you wanted to be free of the body, eventually be free of the physical constraints. And so these are very broad brush explanations, because Gnosticism took various forms, but these were among the things that were common to Gnostics and Gnosticism along the way. Does that help, Harry?
It does. You brought out dualism. Do we not have dualism today? Do we not have a God on one end? We don't have a God of evil, but we have someone of evil who fits into that pattern. So wouldn't we have dualism today?
Well, sure, there is dualism, good and evil. That's always been true. But they took it a step further, or several steps further. In other words, they saw that the evil was physical. That was the error of Gnosticism in that area, was to say that physical things are in some way inherently evil, or they derive from this evil entity. But as Christians, we know that matter is not evil. So Christianity, and the Catholic faith in particular, is not dualistic in that sense. In other words, we regard both matter and spirit as good. As it says in Genesis chapter 2, that when God created everything, he stood there, he observed it and said, it is good. It is very good, in fact. So God created matter as something good. It can be perverted. It can be used for evil. And of course, in the fallen world, material things do cause us pain, but material things in general, as such, are not evil. That's the distinction between the Gnostic view of good and evil, or the dualism of Gnosticism. It's centered upon physical things bad, spiritual things good. The Catholic Church says no, physical things good, spiritual things good. Physical things can be used improperly that can bring evil or misery. Spiritual things can have the same course, they can be used in an improper way that can bring suffering. But both matter and spirit are both good in the eyes of the Catholic Church.
Okay. I'm still a little confused, but I want to thank you very much for your your help.
I'm sorry if I was imprecise or not easy to follow, but just remember that the dualism, there is dualism in the world. There's dualism in the universe. So it's not as though dualism as such is the problem. It's the form that it took with Gnosticism, where the dualism resided in a pitting of matter against spirit and vice versa. That was the error in this category in Gnosticism. But you don't see that in the Catholic Church. I feel like maybe I'm over-explaining it, but if you concentrate on that dimension of it, I think over time it'll become clearer. Anyway, I appreciate the call, Harry. I almost called you Carrie. Harry Carrie. Thanks for that. Let's go now to, let's go to Jeff in Phoenix. Good morning, Jeff.
Hi, Patrick. Love your show. I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you. Thank you.
My question is just to piggyback off the one that was a little bit earlier as far as disruptive behavior with toddlers and church. And I have a three-year-old. We've been taking her for, it's been a couple of years now, but she's still very disruptive. And at times we will take her, I'll take her to the vestibule and she'll still be kicking, screaming and making a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. When it becomes disruptive, when you're, you know, in that part of the church, I mean, is there any other options that you'd suggest? I mean, at one point, I ended up just taking her out to the car, and I hate doing that.
You can do that.
You're actually outside of the church, right?
You can do that. The Lord knows that you're making every effort to be present at Mass. He understands that. And so it's not as though if you get past 300 feet, suddenly you're no longer participating. It's because of your role as dad, you have to take care of this little girl. Maybe the church hall, maybe like in our parish, there is a kind of a smaller church hall that has a simulcast onto a big television on the wall. It has the Mass simulcast into that room. So if you have a noisy child or something, you could sit there and watch the Mass. You're not physically in the same room, but you're nearby. I don't know if your church has that. Some churches will also have in the speakers out in the vestibule or in the hallway where you can hear the Mass there as well. So it's you're present, even if you're not immediately present, but you're still present. And I could understand how that would be frustrating for you as a dad if you're always doing it that way. Is your wife available to help trade off duties with the child so that sometimes you're in the Mass in the church itself?
Yeah, it's funny. What you mentioned before, I was in the same exact position where my wife was getting very frustrated and I didn't realize, but she was doing all the heavy lifting. And so then I realized, well, I need to do more of that. And then, so she does, but I think the main thing was, like my child would get used to that as like, oh, I can get out of church. So then it got to the point, it's like, well, I need something to realize, like, okay, this is not, she needs to realize it's.
Yeah, maybe, I wish I didn't have to go, but I do. Maybe you could start your pedagogy with your daughter saying, listen, you're not allowed to do this at church. And if you are good at church, on the way home, we'll get you a donut. Maybe try that, see how that works. Carrot and a stick. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow. God bless you.